طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that it is broadcast every week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we take a long look at Amal Bashara's new book, Crossing a Line, Laws, Violence, and Roadblocks to Palestinian Political Expression. Amal is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Tufts University, and a Palestinian activist. Crossing a Line is described this way on the book jacket. Palestinians living on different sides of the Green Line make up approximately one-fifth of Israeli citizens and about four-fifths of the population of the West Bank. In both groups, activists assert that they share a single political struggle for national liberation. Yet obstacles inhibit their ability to speak to each other and as a collective. Geopolitical boundaries fragment Palestinians into ever smaller groups. Crossing a Line enters these environments for political expression. Crossing a Line enters the environments for political expression and action of Palestinians who carry Israeli citizenship and Palestinians subject to Israeli military occupation in the West Bank, and considers how Palestinians are differently impacted by dispossession, settler colonialism, and militarism. Amal looks to sites of political practice, journalism, historical commemorations and street demonstrations, social media, in person and on the road, to analyze how Palestinians create collectives in these varied circumstances. She draws on first-hand research, personal interviews, and public media to examine how people shape and reshape meanings in circumstances of constraint. In considering these different environments for political expression and action, Bashara illuminates how expression is always grounded in place, and how a people can struggle together for liberation even when they cannot join together in protest. Here is my conversation with Amal Bashara.
Amal, congratulations on the publication of your book, Crossing the Line. It's a wonderful, very personal documentation of your examination of a fractured, colonized culture, divided by walls and checkpoints, by military occupation and structured de jure apartheid. How does a culture exist under such conditions where travel and communication, and in fact, almost every aspect of life is controlled by a well-funded, heavily militarized occupier? You get into this and a lot more in Crossing the Line, but let's begin with your describing your book, what you're trying to achieve with this meticulous research, what you hope to achieve, and where you hope it might lead.
Thank you so much, John. First of all, it's an honor to be in conversation with you and to, you know, be able to have an audience with This Week in Palestine's listeners. I really value so much the work that you do so valiantly and persistently with this community. So thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And so my goals in working on this book really were to explore something that came up through my personal life and positionality, but that I realized also had a much deeper political significance. So Palestinian citizens of Israel make up about 20% of the population of Israel's citizens inside Israel's 1948 territories. Mm-hmm. And Palestinians who are in the West Bank actually make up 80% of the population of the West Bank, because the other 20% are settlers. They have two very different political statuses. Palestinian citizens of Israel can vote if they choose to in Israeli elections. They have access to Israel's social service network, although they are systematically discriminated against in terms of, for example, funding of municipalities and so forth, right? Palestinians in the West Bank, on the other hand, have been living under Israeli military occupation for over 50 years. And they, you know, obviously do not ever participate, can never participate in Israeli elections. You know, this has been an arbitrary military rule that they have no say in for those decades. However, the Palestinian Authority has been, the West Bank has been for many years the center of Palestinian politics because of the presence of the Palestinian Authority. Now, of course, the Palestinian Authority has many problems, which I address in the book to a certain extent. But it means that, you know, they in a sense feel themselves to be at the center of a certain kind of a politics where Palestinian citizens of Israel have actually been marginalized for many, many decades. So I was really interested in thinking about what keeps these two groups from speaking together and as a collective. I mean, if you think about it, Palestinians are fragmented across many different locations, right? There are Palestinians in Gaza who obviously, you know, can have very little face-to-face interaction with Palestinians who hold Israeli citizenship, or Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in Lebanon, Syria, likewise, you know, really strict fragmentation. Palestinians who hold Israeli citizenship and Palestinians in the West Bank actually have a lot more opportunity to engage, even though there are obstacles. But the legal and geographic and to a certain extent also cultural barriers between them are really significant. And that's something that I wanted to explore, because I think that Palestinian citizens of Israel have a very big role to play in pushing Palestinians as a whole forward towards liberation. And I think obviously all Palestinians do. And what we need to do is to create ways for Palestinians to listen to each other, to work together, to struggle together, while recognizing that the reason why things aren't going to go perfectly is, of course, because of this, you know, fragmentation that's been imposed upon Palestinians by Israeli settler colonialism.
In the course of your research, which took place over really several years, you traveled virtually all of historic Palestine to do your research. And I wonder, tell us how difficult that was in terms of this fragmentation, the walls, the checkpoints, etc. And you're traveling, and I would be interested to know if you were traveling on, when you were driving, when you were traveling on Palestinian plates or Israeli plates, which really would make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I'd also at some point like to get into the part about the vans that you took and the difficulties of traveling without a car. So, you know, this was difficult research just to get around, and which tells a story in itself. So talk to us about how you did this research.
Yeah, well, so I have not been to Gaza since I was, I believe, 2.5. When I was 2.5, I was visiting my family in the Galilee, and we went to Gaza. And there's like a little snapshot of me at the beach in Gaza, but I haven't been to Gaza since then. So I did try to think about and go to many different parts of Palestine, but there were parts that I just, you know, I couldn't go to, like Gaza. But yes, I agree with you that the movement here tells its own story in such a rich way for me myself in my own experiences. So my father was born in Tarshiha, which is in the far northern Galilee. And my father's side of the family are all Israeli citizens. And that's about 2.5 hours from Jerusalem. I did my first major research in Jerusalem and Ramallah, and that research was on journalism. So my family is in Tarshiha, and I have very strong local connections in Bethlehem, in Ida refugee camp, where my partner is from. Mm-hmm. And we can talk later about what it means that I have so many connections coming through men in my life. But I assure you that actually, I have very, very strong, you know, connections with women in both of these locations as well, and through my family, for which I'm very grateful. Movement was a challenge, but in a way, I was going to be doing it anyway, because I was going to be visiting my family in the far northern Galilee. And because usually I was based, my home base was usually in Bethlehem, partly because my partner, you know, cannot legally enter Israel. And, you know, so can't have a summer vacation or a research trip, particularly because we have children, young children, where we need to be divided in that way. So the home base in a way became Bethlehem, and I would travel from there to other places. I usually had an Israeli plated car, and I would rent it from a Palestinian car rental agency in Jerusalem, because these car rental agencies, they specialize in having insurance to cover you on both sides of the green line.
Excuse me, and you were able to rent a car with Israeli plates because you're an American citizen?
Yes.
But your partner, who's a resident of the West Bank, could not.
Right. He could not rent same car. Okay. Right. Yeah. So I would, you know, I was always getting the car and dropping off the car. And, you know, the car was my responsibility in that way. And, you know, yeah, everything about it obviously speaks to the apartheid reality,
right?
And, you know, before we had young children, especially, I used to take a lot more public transportation. And I really think that both kinds of movement are ways to learn about territory and learn about relationships to the state. You know, I really think that every time we get into a car, even in this country, you know, we are kind of in relationship with the state, whether the roads are smooth or rough, whether they are, you know, wide and safe, or they are, you know, curvy and not safe, whatever those circumstances are, you know, that tells us something about how the state has established an environment that's either safe or unsafe for various people, right? And of course, that's even more true in Israel and occupied territories, where, you know, you're dealing with Israeli police and border guards and soldiers and so forth, you know, and, you know, the possibility of checkpoints at every turn. So movement itself was definitely a way where I did a lot of learning about the political situation and how Palestinians also sort of manage the challenges that can come up basically at any time.
Well, it's safe to say that if you were not able to rent a car with Israeli plates, that you literally could not do the kind of research that you did via car anyway. I mean, that because you can't, with the green plates, you can't go into Israel, you can't go into even Jerusalem. It's so limiting. So that the orange plates were, I would think, important. And you were able to get those plates because you're an American citizen.
Yes, absolutely. So the whole research is conditioned on my privilege as an American and also as an Israeli, because I have Israeli citizenship because of my family.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Right. Over the years, there are many areas of Palestine, Israel, that you ventured in the time you spent doing your research and we could focus on. But I'd like to talk initially about the photography project, the link you helped develop that brought youth from Jaffa, now in Israel, and mm-hmm. the Ida camp, which, of course, is in the West Bank, together. Begin by telling us a bit about Jaffa and its history, its significance as an Arab city. Also talk about the Ida refugee camp, its history and significance, and why you chose Jaffa and Ida camp for this juxtaposition.
Yeah, so this was a really fun part of my research. And I mean, I should just say that, you know, the fact that I was only able to do this research because of my privilege as a U.S. citizen and as an Israeli, you know, citizen as well, meant that, you know, I really felt a deep responsibility to make everything really worth it, right? You know, to make my time worth it and to make the time I spend with other people worth it, because I understand that it's something I undertake with great privilege. That said, I will say that the collaboration, the photography exchange between Ida and Jaffa was really fun and exciting. Jaffa is one of the great coastal cities of Palestinians. And like you can think of Jaffa, which is also in English, Jaffa, mm-hmm. and Haifa and Akka. or acre, as it's called in English, as these three, you know, really important port cities, sites of great cosmopolitanism, Palestinian cosmopolitanism before 1948 in the Nakba, and sites with also just, you know, very, very long histories of trade in so many, you know, very, very long histories of trade. You know, a beautiful old city, wonderful, you know, today you can enjoy, you know, fantastic fish and so forth. But in 1948, most Palestinians were expelled from Yaffa and became refugees. And those who were remained were confined in one particular neighborhood in Jaffa. And so, you know, there were kind of multiple dispossessions there because there were the people who became refugees. And then there were, you know, outside of what, you know, became Israel. And then there were also the people who lost their homes, but were able to stay inside and not, you know, not become refugees. So people were really living with those multiple kinds of displacement and violence. Yaffa, also because it's right next to Tel Aviv, has been really, really gentrified over the last decades. So the Yaffa Old City has been gentrified and turned into basically like an artist's area. And really, Palestinian presence has been, you know, erased in this really beautiful Palestinian old city. So that's a very painful thing.
Before 48, it was what, 70-75% of Arab population, at least, maybe even more.
I think even more, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. And today it's what would you say the population of the Arab population in Jaffa is?
I don't have that number on the top of my head, although I think it's in the book, but it's very small, in particular because Yaffa is very small in relationship to Tel Aviv. So, you know, Palestinians, it's in a joint municipality with Tel Aviv. And so the percentage of Palestinians is, you know, very small in the city as a whole.
Yeah, I think in the book, if I recall, it was like 20% now.
Yeah, or even smaller, perhaps.
Yeah, and perhaps even smaller, yeah. So just the transformation of this vibrant Arab commercial city, the port, the orange industry, the trade, et cetera, it was so vital to Palestine, and basically it's gone. Anyway, okay. So I'm sorry, I got off. Off track.
Thank you.
Talk about the relationship of Yaffa and the Aida camp.
So, in some ways, it seems like a strange pairing, if you will, right? You know, because Yaffa has this tremendous history as a, you know, a great city of Palestinian cosmopolitanism. And thank you for mentioning the oranges, which are super important in Palestinian history. Mm-hmm. Yaffa oranges. And the citrus industry. And Aida refugee camp, of course, was established in the early 1950s after the Nakba. And it became home to Palestinians from dozens of Palestinian villages that had been depopulated during the Nakba. So it's quite small, it's smaller than Yaffa, and, you know, surrounded on two sides by the separation wall, very militarized due to Israeli military presence. Why did I choose those two locations? I mean, in some ways, no location was going to stand for the greater whole. You know, Aida refugee camp is not like the epitome of all of the West Bank, and Yaffa is not like the epitome of all Palestinian areas inside Israel's 1948 territories, right? But there are two places that are, you know, they can, an interesting story can be told from both of them, and both Bethlehem, you know, has obviously a very long and important history in terms of Palestinians, but also in global history, right? So Aida refugee camp has a complicated relationship to the rest of Bethlehem, and Yaffa has a complex relationship to Tel Aviv. So they are both sort of smaller parts of larger municipal areas and places with strong local identities. And places that are really, you know, struggling in terms of gentrification. And so it was interesting to have people from those two locations engage with each other through photography in this project.
And that took travel from the young people in Yaffa. And you have a wonderful description of their concern about traveling to the Aida refugee camp for the safety, because Aida is a camp where the Israeli military are very active, often in the camp. And I thought it was a wonderful part of the book, the way you talked about that. So I wonder if you just take a few minutes to talk about that that concern, that, you know, relationship.
Yeah. So I applied for this grant to do this photography exchange at a time when things seemed, you know, relatively calm, if you will, for Palestinians. But by the time we began the research, this was summer of 2014, which was one of the summers of, you know, one of Israel's most ferocious wars on Gaza. And that really changed things for everybody. You know, there was a lot more protests in the West Bank and for Palestinians inside Israel, a lot more tension in general. So while I had imagined that maybe the Palestinians from Aida refugee camp could like apply for permits and go to Yaffa to enjoy, you know, learning about Yaffa and being together there, you know, that was completely impossible by the time the project was underway. And, you know, they didn't want to apply for permits either because they felt that that was kind of an odious thing. Like, why should we engage with the Israeli military authorities at all? Right.
Yeah. Right.
So it was sort of left to the Palestinians from Yaffa to come visit Aida a few times. And, you know, we had this all set up and we had the cars arranged and the timing arranged. And, you know, I had hoped that this would happen frequently, but I knew it was probably going to happen only once or twice. So the night before the visit, though, one of the leaders of the Yaffa group was still having reservations about coming to Aida. And I, you know, I tried to reassure her. And I thought, well, what am I going to do here? I think maybe the best move would be to put her directly in contact with somebody from Aida, because maybe she doesn't fully, you know, have confidence in me as this American, you know, Palestinian American researcher. You know, what do I have to say about, you know, broad systems of safety or structures of safety, right? Maybe I should just put her directly in touch. Sure enough, when I did that, not only maybe was she feeling a little bit more comfortable making the trip once she'd spoken to the local coordinator in Aida refugee camp, but I think she also felt like she couldn't quite say no to him either, because of course, you know, when you receive an invitation like this, you know, it becomes a kind of an obligation to go and to participate and to do that engagement, right? So they came and, you know, they called me so that I could meet their car and then they could follow me in, which, you know, another indication of, you know, how fraught and difficult these moments are. You know, the GPS doesn't necessarily work. You know, you don't know what to expect from the checkpoints. You don't, you know, people don't feel comfortable making that journey, right? So I'm going out to get the group. And by the time, and when I left, everything was fine. You know, I was like, okay, this is going to be a nice, smooth day. And I told them that on the phone. By the time we arrived in Aida refugee camp, there were Israeli soldiers in the camp. You know, and, you know, we had to park the visitor's car in a place that was, you know, a little bit away from the action to protect it from the possibility of falling, you know, tear gas canisters and so forth. So there, it's really unpredictable questions around safety. We had a really like compelling and interesting afternoon, but, you know, it was really interesting to see how people managed, you know, their will to be together and their desire to, you know, be good hosts and good guests in a circumstance that really wasn't so comfortable, right? So we were like doing these invitations or these introductions of everybody around a circle. And meanwhile, you know, outside these sound canisters, sound bomb canisters started exploding outside and, you know, and all these other like military noises and people sitting around the table. It happened to be somebody from Aida who was talking at the time, just continued talking like nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And finally, somebody from Yaffa said, listen, okay, fine, fine. But just could you stop and tell us what's going on outside? Like, you know, we need some explanation here. And, you know, so that, you know, we did that and we managed to have a really fulfilling day together. But, you know, it just speaks to how difficult it is to collaborate across these two sites and the different kinds of dangers and tensions that emerge when people do that work.
Yeah. It's interesting that it was a photography project, because I think the role of photography in Palestinian society with its ability to document is really important. Say something about the role of photography in the resistance.
Oh, yeah. That's such a great question. So, you know, I think photography, well, first of all, I should say that in our project, we chose photography in part because it was, you know, this was in 2014, easy to share, like, easier than a video to share. It could be downloaded quickly and moved quickly, even more quickly than now you could do videos more easily. But photography was, really easy to share. I think that today, both photographs and videos play such an important role in documenting what's happening, holding Israel accountable, or at least, keeping a public record of Israel's crimes. Also, portraying Palestinian heroism and bravery and attempts to, confront Israel's occupation. So, and photography, of course, is really, really accessible at this point, right? So it's a kind of, representational work that everybody can engage with. So that's one of the reasons why we chose it. In our project, I was also trying to get people to think just in a really everyday way about space. I didn't really want people to take pictures that were, any way that was going to be dangerous for them, certainly. But we did want them to think just about, what do you see when you wake up in the morning? And what's the last time you interacted with Israeli authorities? Are the streets clean and comfortable or not? What makes them clean and comfortable at a particular moment or not? And, how can we capture that in photography and create a kind of a Palestinian conversation around like sort of everyday issues of space that people are living in,
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, years ago, develop as a strategy getting cameras into the hands of folks in the West Bank to document what the military was doing, because it wasn't covered, and if it was, they didn't believe it, and whatever. But the images are difficult, to dismiss. So I've always been interested in the role of photography in Palestine and the work that's done in the Lodgy Center and places like that.
Yes, yeah. There's some wonderful work on those B'Tselem projects. A book called Screenshots by Rebecca Stein, mm-hmm. That goes into those kinds of projects of documenting and B'Tselem's work and trying to document and working collaboratively with Palestinians to document what's going on in the occupied territories. And also, the big problem we have both here and in Israeli society is sort of an unwillingness to believe the image, just ways of interpreting basically sort of this problem of facts not being accepted as facts. Mm. So that's a whole other story that can be explored. But, thankfully wasn't really part of my project, because what we were trying to do is just have this Palestinian dialogue among two different Palestinian groups living in different circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's the exposure of what's happening is, of course, what Israel is trying to censor, and why they're attacking journalists like Shireen Abu Akleh and others, other journalists. It's exposing, and the Israeli lobby is spending millions of dollars to quash the press, not only in Israel, Palestine, but in the United States. So we depend so much on them, and we depend so much on their images. So
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We do.
Yeah. I also wanted to talk a bit about Al Walija.
Uh-huh.
Which is quite close to Ida refugee camp. And it's in the news a lot, and I'm not sure people understand the significance of Al Walija. And I wonder if you'd talk about that a little bit, what's going on there and why it's such a hot spot.
Yeah, I happen to, just be looking at a picture of Al Walija right now and a protest or commemoration of the Nakba that happened in Al Walija that I was able to attend. So Al Walija is a village on, between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And in 1948, Palestinians in Al Walija were, Israel pushed them off of their lands and their homes onto their agricultural land. So they had to build a new village of Al Walija on the agricultural land inside what became the West Bank. So they're very, very close to the Green Line. In recent years, Israel has basically deemed so many buildings there to be illegal and to, you know, thus being subject to demolition. And so many, there's been a lot of home demolitions that have happened in Walaja. Schools have been threatened also with demolition. And there's been more and more land confiscations in and around El Walaja due to the construction of the wall right on the edges of El Walaja.
Right. I think you said in your book also that the original village is now actually on the Israeli side of the Green Line. Is that right?
Yes. It's like they moved from one hill to another. They stayed on their agricultural lands, but they had to leave their homes.
I didn't know that. I did go to Al Walaja years ago, is before the wall was built, but the wall was planned. And I remember we parked at the monastery there and then walked out into Al Walaja and were shown where the wall was going to go, et cetera. And you could sense, because it's so close to the Green Line, and it was going to be difficult for Al Walaja to exist. And it's a shame what's happened.
It's this totally beautiful part of the country as well, like out on these hilltops covered with olive trees. And it's a really special part of the country. There's some springs there that people have enjoyed, just to take an outing and go enjoy the spring. And that's one of those springs has also been confiscated and turned into a national park that's now inaccessible to Palestinians. So the layers and kinds of dispossession that people in the El Walaja had, you know, lived through and confronted and resisted is really tremendous.
Talk about you travel also to the north quite a bit. You talk about Nablus a good bit. And I thought one of the fascinating parts of the book was your explaining your travel to Nablus when you were using the vans, etc. And, you know, just illustrated what's really going on there. But what's the significance of Nablus in the resistance? Israel really seems to target it as a place of great resistance or something that gets them going whenever they deal with Nablus. But you hinted at that a bit in your book about the difficulty, and so I'd love to have you talk a little bit about Nablus and its significance.
Yeah, I think there's a joke in the book that people were telling during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, where a soldier stops two people and, you know, asks each one of them where they're from, and one says he's from Ramallah and the other says he's from Nablus. And so the soldier says, "Okay, great." So he says to the one from Ramallah, "Here, you watch the one from Nablus." You know, the idea being that, that Ramallah perhaps has been, co-opted and turned into this sort of station of the Palestinian Authority, which is itself very complicit with Israeli rule, whereas Nablus remains this space of independence and of resistance. Nablus is a really big city. It's a gorgeous city, you know, located between these two mountains with a tremendous old city. And some really beautiful, like, local industry, like olive oil production, great sweets, known for its sweets as well as its barbecue. So it's kind of a city of many legends in that way. It also is where the largest refugee camp in the West Bank is located, Balata Refugee Camp. And refugee camps are very often centers of resistance.
Yeah.
So, I think because it has been challenging the Palestinian Authority in various ways for so long, and because of the refugee camp, it has been a center of resistance. And for many years during the first period of my longer field work in the early 2000s, you know, it was one of the places that, you know, if one tried to go there, you know, you could, sometimes you just wouldn't get in at all because the whole city would be closed down. You know, it also is home to a few important universities, most notably Najah University. And, you know, so students who are coming from surrounding villages trying to go into Nablus, like very often would try to go and they would be turned away. They wouldn't be able to go to school for the day. So this question of fragmentation and how Palestinians are kept from communicating with each other and learning together and working together and struggling with each other happens across all these different levels, you know, between yeah. Palestinian citizens of Israel and Palestinians in the West Bank, but also just, you know, even within one region of the northern West Bank where villagers can't go to, you know, the main city in their area, Nablus.
Yeah, and it's a similar problem in the south around Hebron, which is also a flashpoint and has a very interesting story. So last few minutes, would you talk a little bit about Hebron and its similarity to Nablus or the other hot spots, or and its uniqueness?
Hebron also, of course, has a tremendous religious significance. But one of the things that really distinguishes Hebron from other Palestinian cities is that there are Israeli settlements in the heart of the city, and those settlements are especially right-wing settlers. So, you know, there are settlements in the West Bank that are populated by, people who are living there because the housing is subsidized, it's less expensive, they're bedroom communities for Israeli cities inside Israel's 1948 territories. But those in Hebron are really there for ideological purposes. And they do their best to make Palestinian lives in the city very, very difficult, particularly in the old city, harassing Palestinians, throwing garbage into Palestinian living spaces, introducing really, so much violence, making it impossible for Palestinians to feel safe, literally in their own homes and on their own streets. And Israeli settler violence is, of course, protected by Israeli soldiers. So it's a site of tremendous tension, and has been, for decades.
Yeah. I know when, years ago, I think it was 2008, traveled to Hebron, with a group, and the old marketplace was vacant. It was just I don't know whether it still is. I imagine probably is pretty much cleansed by the Israelis. But we went, we walked into the and there was no one around except some Israeli soldiers, and then we saw a young woman holding a baby with an older man walking, and it was like a curfew situation. We go, what's going on here? And it turns out that the baby was sick, and they were trying to get to a doctor, and the Israeli military started to sort of harass them, et cetera. And the guide we were with said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to surround them and we're going to walk them to the doctor. And so, all of these Americans, et cetera, and internationals surrounded them, and walked them up to the checkpoint, got through. But, that was a chilling reminder of the kind of life that they live in Hebron.
It is truly, it's difficult to imagine that sense of insecurity where just getting to the doctor can be such a threat. And of course, that's been true for Palestinians at so many junctures,
right?
Over the last decades, checkpoints, which always are not just a space where one is, checked. They're also, a site of potential violence, right? Or of not being able to allow to be passed at all. So yeah, that's a really quintessential Palestinian moment there that you're recognizing and telling us about.
Your book hasn't been out that long, but are you getting, what kind of feedback are you getting?
Oh, I've been really enjoying talking to people about it. One of the most exciting things for me recently was to be able to talk to the Association of Palestinian Anthropologists about it last week. And it's really interesting because they are in the thick of, it's an association of Palestinian anthropologists that tries also to bring together Palestinians from across all these different places, mm-hmm. Those who carry Israeli citizenship, those who are on the West Bank, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the diaspora, in other places. So their work, they, I'm part of this organization. You know, we definitely have our work cut out for us as these Palestinian anthropologists. And it was really exciting to see how they recognized in my book a common struggle there that the Palestinian anthropologists have as a small collective and that all Palestinians have as a larger collective. Mm-hmm. So that was a really, you know, fulfilling time for me to get to take in how other people were thinking about the book in that way.
I'd be interested, as a Palestinian woman who is a scholar and publishes and speaks out, you're an activist. What kind of pushback, if any, are you getting from the Israeli lobby or whatever, or the university, or, you know, those that are pressuring academics to silence them? Are you witnessing any of that?
For this book, it hasn't been out that long, like you say, I think one thing is this is an interesting book because it does focus a lot on Palestinian citizens of Israel who tend not to be addressed at all. It's really trying to cultivate a conversation among Palestinians. It's also very ethnographic, you know, it's really grounded. It tells a lot of specific stories that speaks to a larger case. And in that way, I think it's harder to maybe push back against. It doesn't, you know what I mean? It makes big claims, but it does it through small moments.
And it is so well documented. I can't believe how many pages of footnotes you have with your bibliography. And I thought, how did she ever keep this together in her head, doing all this research and then distill it into a book? I don't know how you guys do that, but it's amazing. You're right. It is so well documented. Unbelievable. It's hard to find a sentence where there isn't a footnote. Well, anyway, I really enjoyed the book. I think it's a very important book. I hope people will read it because not only its historical value, but it also is such a snapshot of what's happening. And your experiences take us through all of that, and it's wonderful. So congratulations, and thanks for writing it. And I hope we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you reading it and sharing it on This Week in Palestine. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care, Amal. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my conversation with Palestinian activist and professor of anthropology, Amal Bishara. She continues to be closely involved with the Palestinian resistance both here in Boston area as well as in the West Bank. Her anchor there is the Ida refugee camp in Bethlehem. She's a frequent visitor with her husband, who grew up in the camp and where his family still lives. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. If you want to sleep a little later on Sunday morning and want to hear the program later in the day or at any other time of the week via the instant archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is temporarily on this archive for only 2 weeks. You can also stream This Week in Palestine live every Friday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time on KKRN.org, a community radio station in Redding, California. You can find all our past broadcasts on our permanent archive at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.